Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro. And this week, my guest is technology journalist Ryan Foss. Ryan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here.
Thank you for joining me on the show. I've been an admirer of your work for a long time.
Likewise. It's kind of funny. We actually have never run into each other at anything before now.
Yeah, so I'm happy to have you on the show. For the listeners, I want to introduce you. You are a technology journalist and author who's been writing about Apple, business, and enterprise IT topics and the mobile industry for over a decade. You also spent a large portion of your past 15 years in the systems and network engineering and IT management fields as an IT director, systems administrator, trainer, and all-around multi-platform, I love it, and mobile device technology consultant. And you are a contributing writer current day for Computer World.
That about says a lot.
Yeah, I love your articles at Computer World. I should note also that in 2008, you were awarded the Neil National Business Journalism Award for your work featured in Computer World's Week of Leopard. I'm pretty sure that was Mac OS X Leopard introduced in October of 2007.
Exactly.
What did you do in that series?
I wrote a little bit of everything in that series, but the biggest thing I did was talking about Leopard Server and how Apple had really begun bringing its server platform into the small business arena.
Ah, okay. So we're going to get to Mac OS Server in a few minutes. I want to come back to that. But first, tell me about your early years. How did you get into computers? Tell me your first computer was an Apple II, like all my other guests, please.
I'd love to be able to say that, but my first but my first computer was a Commodore 64.
That's number two on the list. So you're okay. Right. You're okay.
I actually didn't touch an Apple product until I was in high school.
What did you do on the Commodore? Did you just use it as a game machine, or did you start writing basic code?
I actually did start writing basic code. That was my first exposure to programming.
You know, I wish there was a meme or a way to then tell these companies about how they launched the careers of about 200 of us with the Commodore 64 and the Apple II. It is a recurring theme. It's a scary theme.
So I didn't touch an Apple product until I was in high school. And in my first book, I actually had a shout out to my high school journalism teacher. In the acknowledgments page, where I said, "Mr. Smith, thank you for teaching me that I really wanted to work as a writer, but also for sitting me down in front of a Mac for the first time."
Ah, so the writing aspect of it started earlier than I even imagined.
Yeah, and you know, if that journalism office had like PCs in it, my life would have been entirely different.
More miserable, I think.
So. Yeah.
Did that carry you into college as journalism or computer science?
Actually, neither. I actually went to design school. So I was actually heading towards an architectural design background. And in the middle of that, my mother had a series of catastrophic health problems. And I took time off from school and the company that eventually became About.com was looking for writers about various topics, and one of them was Macintosh hardware. And so I thought, well, if I'm taking like the semester off, this would be something I can do to earn a little extra money. And then I ended up doing that for 4 years, during which I got approached to work on my first book.
So the book came before you really launched your career as an IT network manager.
It did. It was actually the book was actually the burnout from the book was what launched me into the IT field.
This Peach Pit? What was the book?
This was Troubleshooting, Maintaining, and Repairing Macs.
I have a copy in the basement, you know.
I have a couple of copies familiar. In the basement. Used to joke I have the most egotistical display stand ever because it's actually a copy of that book. It is for like my neck and my shoulders, the perfect ergonomic option. So it's like sitting literally under my display on my desk all the time. But I got offered that book deal when I was 23, and I had never really written anything longer than a few pages. And I agreed to write a 900-page book in 6 months.
Oh my.
Because that sounded perfectly reasonable.
You know, writing a book, confirm this if you agree, but writing a book is not just about writing. It's about consistency and organization and thoroughness and everything you don't think about when you think about starting a book.
No, that's actually very true. One of the most important aspects of writing a book to me is actually fleshing out the table of contents, because that serves as the organizational structure that everything else is laid on top of.
Which probably is dynamic in itself, because then you end up rearranging and rewriting and reorganizing. It can become really tedious.
And that's how that particular book went from the 900 pages it was supposed to be to the almost 1,200 pages it was.
Oh, my. And oh, my.
After doing that for 8 months, I was like, I need a break from writing.
Was the money worth it, though?
The money was worth it. And the exposure and the experience itself was definitely worth it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So after you were burned out, then what happened?
Shortly after that, I actually ended up working for Apple. I was a Mac genius in one of the first stores to open. I think, the Crossgate store in Albany, New York. We were the 10th store. I did that for 9 months and Apple laid me off. And then I started taking consulting work in New York City. And the biggest project I did there was, working at MTV Networks, which was actually quite an awesome summer gig.
Oh, cool.
And during that time, I got hired to work at a community college in the Mid-Hudson Valley, which I did for 2 years. And the way I went back to writing during that period was I spent an entire summer break complaining every day to my boss that somebody needed to write a book on macOS Server. And at one point, I think he got tired of listening to me and just said, "You're an author. Go write the book." So that's more or less what I did.
Did you write it concurrently in the evenings, or did you just take a leave of absence?
I took a leave of absence to do that. And I actually ended up working with a co-author at O'Reilly, who unfortunately is no longer with us. And it was a much easier experience than my first book, because I had sort of the knowledge of what my limits were and also the knowledge of, you know, how many pages it's actually going to take to discuss a particular topic.
Those were glorious days, because there are many of us in the industry. I was at Lockheed Martin who were using Solaris or SGI Ericks, and we had Sun workstations on our desks, and Apple gets into this beautiful BSD operating system with Mac OS X Server, and then they bring out the Xserve, and we are just hands over head in joy with what that is. Pre-iPhone days, when Apple was totally focused on Macs and servers and Mac OS X Server and the Unix underpinnings and all these geeky tools and terminals and daemons, and we were just in heaven.
Yeah, and you know, I remember the first time I was deploying a lab, and I, you know, had NetBoot running and all the Macs booted up at the same time, booted from the network, went through the installation process. And I just had this moment of like standing in this room completely alone and starting to laugh because I'm like, wow, this actually all works.
I haven't heard about NetBoot in years. Does it still work?
Sort of. I mean, Apple has the original NetBoot service for running the complete operating system from a network image. That's no longer there, but NetInstall, which is up through now, still been a deployment option, essentially is the underlying of NetBoot, because the machine will still boot from a network source. It just doesn't boot into the consumer operating system. It goes directly into the install process.
Okay. All right. All right. So did you start writing from Computer World about this time?
Yes. And actually, my reason for starting to write for Computer World, I did not foresee that I would be writing for them 15 years later. but when I was getting ready to pitch a book on Panther Server, I thought, well, you know, if I have a couple of recent publishing credits, just to prove that I actually, you know what I'm doing writing about OS X Server. I pitched a few ideas to Computer World solely for the credits, and, you know, 15 years later, I'm still writing for them.
I want to get back to some of your articles in a minute, but I wanted to ask you, was it the network and IT administration elements of your career that brought you into this multi-platform expertise, this sort of neutrality that you have? It's glorious.
It really was, because, you know, I kind of cut my teeth on Apple when you really had to prove that Macs could be good network citizens the same as all the Windows PCs out there.
Oh, that vicious rumor about Apple Talk chattiness, did that bite you?
That actually did not bite me that much.
Okay, it did me. It did me. That rumor went around for years, tried to squash
it. Oh, yeah,
I remember,
like, you know, 5, 6, 7 years after that, I'm like, we're not even using Apple Talk anymore. It's actually, you know, the AFP, Apple Filing Protocol, that we're using.
Yeah. So you have written for a lot of different places. You've written for Enterprise Mobile Today, Inform IT. You have books from PeachBit. You've written for Cult of Mac, Cult of Android, and Datamation. Are you still writing for any of those guys, or is it Computer World mostly?
Right now, it's mostly Computer World. For a while, IDG had a sister site to Computer World during the whole boom of consumerization of IT that was called Site World. Site being C-I-T-E, consumerization of IT in the enterprise. And I actually wrote a lot for them for almost 3 years. I was actually the first person to start writing for that site when it was launching. So that actually, beyond just Computer World, like some of the other IDG sites I've written for as well. I've had a couple of discussions about possibly doing some stuff back at Cult of Mac again. But right now that's just very preliminary, and we'll see if anything comes of it.
That's a great site. I like Cult of Mac a lot.
Yeah, that was actually a really great experience writing for them. And one of the things that I loved is that, you know, you actually did have like a virtual press bullpen where we'd all be, you know, discussing everything as it was coming in live and as we were posting to the site.
Did you guys use Slack to kind of create a watering hole?
Slack wasn't particularly big when I was still writing for them yet. So the one tool that we used a lot was HipChat.
I haven't heard of that. Because I haven't heard a lot of things.
They basically allowed us just to have a live chat room. And we would also do, you know, calls over Skype and stuff like that.
Now, even though you are splendidly platform capable, I'm sure you might have a minor reference. I wanted to ask you, what's your go-to system? We were talking before the show.
Yeah, you know, my go-to system really is a Mac. It's a MacBook Air that I love. It's gotten a little long in the tooth, so as my primary machine needs to be replaced. And I have a desktop set up with a Mac Mini. I actually really love the Mac Mini form factor. So
have you
I'm
been lamenting
that
the
we see a
fate?
Nice update to it.
You know what I think is taking so long is I'm going to drop this on you towards the end of the show. But I have some theories about why the Mac Mini is taking so long. So we'll get to that in a second. So are you an iPhone user? I bet you are.
I am an iPhone user. But I've also used Android. I've used Windows Phone. If you Google Ryan Foss, Computer World, Windows Phone, you'll actually see the review that I wrote a few years ago. I actually was very sad when Microsoft really stopped developing Windows Phone as its own sort of platform, because I thought they really had...
I wasn't. There's that glorious video of Steve Ballmer reacting to the original iPhone back in 2007.
Yes.
And it's all over the internet. And every time everybody writes an article about that, about the origin of the iPhone, they drag out that Steve Ballmer thing where he laughs Subsidized. No real keyboard. It's going nowhere.
And there are a few, you know, things of the folks from BlackBerry basically saying the same thing.
Yeah, that was an amazing... It's only been a few years ago, but we tend to forget institutionally about the companies that the iPhone put out of business.
Yeah. BlackBerry, Nokia, those are the two that really come... Palm.
Sony Ericsson, you hardly ever hear those phones anymore.
Yeah, I actually have a drawer in my desk that I call the graveyard of old phones where they go to die, because I have like all manner of phones I've either written about, tested, used, whatever.
I call mine a museum. Yours is a graveyard.
Well, I've got like some old iPhones. I have some really old Android phones that I really never want to touch again. Android is very nice today. The very first couple of versions, not so much. There's even a Palm Pre in there, I think.
So it's a good point to take a break here now. We got to break away for a second. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm chatting with technology journalist Ryan Foss. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you. I'm chatting with Ryan Foss, technology journalist. So I want to just circle back to this Android thing. I read a lot about how when you buy your Android phone from a carrier, updates are not pushed out very often. The Democratic National Committee just switched over to all iPhones because of that and the confidence in the frequent updates to iOS. Are you in that camp where you would advise people to rest on the security of the iPhone compared to Android, or do you think that's not an issue anymore?
I think it's still an issue. The big problem with Android, of course, is fragmentation. And it really depends. I tell people, if you are going to go Android, go with like the Pixel phones, or before that, the Nexus phones, something that is basically pure Android as it's created by Google, because then you're much more likely to get the updates that you need. Whereas some of the other manufacturers, you're not even certain if you're ever going to get certain updates. And I think Apple really does have the most secure mobile option on the planet right now. So, and I don't see that changing.
Why do you think the updates are so seldom? Is it because the carriers can't be bothered? They don't care about the security of their systems? It's too much of an admin nightmare? What's driving that negligence?
My impression is it's largely because when the manufacturers and or carriers get a new version of Android, they will ship it on all their flagship phones. And once that happens, there's no financial incentive really for them to go in and update regularly, because they're not going to get any more money as a manufacturer from you using that particular phone. They're going to get more money if you buy a newer version of it.
So the summary is, we've made our money. We don't care about your security. Tough.
Yeah. And in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Google is kind of trying to deal with this with their Project Treble, which is kind of abstracting the hardware from the Android user experience. So there's a layer there where Google can actually update most of Android without the manufacturers having to vet it and having to make their own modifications. I don't know how well this initiative is going to play out over the long term. Google has kind of tried to do reigning carriers like this and manufacturers like this several times before, and the problem still persists. So I would definitely, for almost anybody, I would actually really suggest an iPhone is as the option, both from usability and from definitely a security and management perspective.
Apple was prescient. They really thought this out from square one. They knew what was coming, and they made it stick with AT&T on the original phone so that Apple could seize and maintain control of the customer update experience. It was very forward-looking. I'm so glad Apple did that right the first time.
Yeah, and a lot of people like don't necessarily realize that even with the what we would now call iOS 2 or iPhone OS 2, they really started layering in enterprise functionality and security that early in 2008. And a lot of people don't necessarily think about that. A lot of people in sort of the enterprise mobility space, you know, consider iOS 4 to be where enterprise capabilities were introduced by Apple, but it was actually 2 years before that with iOS 2.
Tell me about that.
Initially,
is this the connection to the Microsoft directory services?
It was actually connectivity with Exchange, which is Microsoft's messaging service. That actually provided at least a way for companies to remote wipe the device, as well as to support push mail rather than your phone checking periodically for new messages. Apple also created a format for securing and pre-configuring the device, known as essentially a configuration profile. And at that point, you had to go through a few hoops to get the configuration profile onto each phone. It wasn't in any way an automated process, but the basic ability that built out into Apple's...
there's an admin tool where the IT manager can sit at his desk and he can roll out updates and lock down
phones.
It wasn't
that powerful. It, like I said, it was you would create these configuration profiles and then you would like email them to somebody and say, open this on your iPhone, and the profile would load into the phone.
Okay.
What Apple got to when they introduced their mobile device management or MDM platform in 2010 with iOS 4, they actually had the ability for the device to check in with an MDM server, receive a number of different configuration profiles and security profiles. And so that's where it really got to the point where it was starting to be automated.
Fraction of companies know how to do this and are willing to do it? Or do they just hand the phone in the box to the employee and say, here's your new phone?
Well, at this point, they can actually hand the phone to the employee in the box. That's with Apple's device enrollment program. Any device sold by Apple or by one of its authorized resellers to a business or to a school, the phone itself can be... tracked so that the first time the phone boots into the setup, it'll actually know which management server to look for, and it will go and find it. And so then the phone will configure itself completely. So at this point, it's completely hands off. You just basically need to have a database of like the serial numbers and the purchase orders in order to make it happen.
Cool. Well, we got to move on. There's so much to talk about. So one reason I love your work so much is because you write about Apple's enterprise issues that few other authors I've seen are able to do competently. John Welsh does a good job. He's been on the show. I don't know if you've seen John Welsh's work, but he worked for Kansas City Insurance Company. He got to be deep into enterprise issues.
But, I I do know his work. I've never actually met him, but we actually, for a while, lived not that far from each other.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's really into this enterprise stuff. But you are, too, and you are really good at it. And that's why I first started reading your work, because I would read articles from you that were so deep on the enterprise issues. I remember one article a long time ago, if I remember correctly, about XServe management. And I thought, there's nobody else writing about this stuff that I found. Nobody deep enough, experienced enough. And your articles were long and thorough and gave me a headache, and I loved them.
Well, I guess I should, like, you know, tell Computer World to provide everyone with, you know, a free sample of Excedrin.
So I wanted to talk to you about modern day, about macOS Server. We've talked about macOS 10 Server, Panther, and Leopard before, but nowadays there have been some changes. macOS Server, as I mentioned earlier on the show, started off as a sort of an enterprise-y, Linux-like enterprise server. Not that they're the same operating system, but, you know, replete with all the bells and whistles and compilers and daemons and admin tools and stuff that the consumer didn't need, that we didn't need in our homes and small businesses. But recently, Apple has shifted its focus and structure of macOS Server. And you wrote an article recently at Computer World, How to Navigate the Shifting Sands of macOS Server. Tell me about that. What's changing and why?
What's changing at this point, I'll touch back to Leopard very briefly. With Leopard Server, Apple made macOS Server extremely user-friendly. So the core services, anybody who could navigate a Mac could actually set up the basic services like authentication and file sharing and email. And that's sort of where Apple has left macOS Server positioned, is really in the small business market. And what they announced at the beginning of the year is that they were going to deprecate virtually all of the services that run on macOS Server. And the explanation that they provided is that most of these services, particularly for small businesses, are easily met using cloud solutions for product, be it Office 365 or G Suite or, you know, what have you. So if it's easier and more effective for people to be doing that with a cloud service, you know, Apple seems to have become of the mind that this platform isn't necessarily needed by that audience as much anymore.
Is the thinking that the institutional organizations with many people on the team are better positioned to deal with security threats, and that these daemons that you configure as a, you know, maybe a XServe is gone, but, you know, a powerful desktop system, for one person in a small business to deal with all the security issues of these different daemons is too much of a load? Is that one way to look
at it? I think there's a big aspect of that with the security. I think with the overall management, and this is, I mentioned SiteWorld earlier, one of the articles that I wrote while I was there was I took the nonprofit I was an IT director for from 2004 to 2006, and I wrote 10 years later, how would I, you know, approach the problems of this organization? And I would have approached them completely differently. I wouldn't have put in, like, a server infrastructure. I wouldn't have, you know, had dedicated leased lines connecting all the facilities. I would have just thrown everything into the cloud, and it would have been a much simpler, more secure, more cost-effective solution than the old school, you know, running all the cable and managing your own servers and things. And it was actually one of the pieces that I've written over the years that really, you know, I really loved, because it really, you know, it was interesting for me to do that thought experiment and then to write about it. And so it's really kind of along the same lines, I think, that Apple has kind of seen, okay, a lot of our customers that we had for this maybe are better served with a different set of tools. And so what has happened is a lot of the services for macOS 10 Server, email, web, wiki, VPN, file sharing, Apple is removing support from macOS Server. But all of those services are based on open source solutions. So Apple has put out a migration guide to go from macOS 10 Server to just running the open source version of the services. So if people want to stay with macOS Server or want to stay at least with those services, there's a pretty straightforward way of doing that. What I suggested for almost all organizations is use this as an opportunity to decide what you want your infrastructure, what you want your services in.
How much of a security burden do you want to bear by running your own web server and your own SMTP server and so on?
Yeah, exactly. Do you want to do that, or do you want to look, forward? And, since everything is moving to the cloud anyway, is it really best for you to, if you're going to do a migration, go directly to the cloud, whatever cloud solution you choose, rather than going from that to an open source version of these tools, and then eventually down the road ending up at a cloud service anyway?
That's a great explanation, and I hope everybody goes to Computer World and registers to read that full text of that article that you wrote, How to Navigate the Shifting Sands of macOS Server, because it really describes the situation well. And as you just put it, it's not the end of days. It's not that Apple is being perverse. As you gave a great description of what Apple's motivation is. So thanks for filling in the listeners in on that.
Absolutely. And like I said, I think it's really one of these things that from an IT perspective, okay, let me sit down and let me not just deal with what the immediate thing is to keep the lights on over the next, few months. Let me actually look back at, what I need to accomplish for my company, for my users, and really come up with a strategy that's going to reach into the future.
Right, right. Okay, so next topic. So you are a great observer of Apple's directions, and you always have keen insights into the delicacies of Apple's real motivations and expertise in the enterprise. At Computer World, you wrote, four industries Apple is set to disrupt. I looked through that, and it's a very interesting take, because some people off the cuff have a sort of circumspect approach to Apple and the enterprise without understanding the four key areas that you identified: healthcare, graphics, media, marketing, journalism, and retail. And it's an excellent article, and it gives you real insights into what people are doing with tools that Apple's provided in the enterprise, as opposed to backing it out the other way and trying to approach it from a traditional enterprise-y perspective. So fill us in on that article. It was great.
That one was really interesting, because I had to sit down and think about, what came out of Apple's event a couple of weeks ago. And, there really was a big push for healthcare. And Apple's really been driving hard at healthcare for quite a while now. There's healthcare, and health kits spawned research kit and care kit. And more recently, Apple is moving to make the health app on your phone a tool for accessing information from your doctor's office, from hospital visits, and literally putting all of your healthcare in one spot. And it's been really fascinating to watch, because they've kind of flown under the radar a bit with this, but they've assembled such an incredible team of people from the healthcare industry that are working on it, including if I'm remembering correctly, some people who have experience working with the FDC and NIH and, really the major healthcare institutions of the US. And I really see Apple, trying to be that sort of glue that takes your fitness and your actual medical data and your prescriptions and even your emergency contacts and puts them together in a really easy to use way that allows somebody to take control of their health information in ways that at this point, even like your doctor can't do. And because there's been a lot of push for electronic records, but the electronic record systems often don't interoperate too well. So the fact that Apple is actually saying, okay, your iPhone can reach into all of these different places where there's an electronic record of you, and it can put it like right in front of you, all the data, all the lab stuff, your fitness stuff, you know, any sort of conditions or prescriptions you have. It's really an amazing thing that they're doing. And I can see where they're going probably over the next couple of years is going to be being that glue. I think if you look beyond that, you're going to really see Apple driving healthcare technology in a lot of different ways.
So journalism is one of the other topics that was interesting to me and is disruptive. One doesn't think about Apple getting involved with or disrupting journalism, but you had a great take on it.
Oh, my take is basically partly from my own life. You know, you now can be a photojournalist just with an iPhone. You have like the technology where you don't need to have a camera crew following you around. You don't have to like record something and then get the tape back to the studio. You can edit it and have it, you know, polished and ready to go right where you are.
One of my former guests, Mark Malkoff, who does the Carson podcast, took a goat into the Soho store in New York and had his wife hold the phone because he didn't want to have a camera rig on the shoulder that get thrown out. And she just, with an iPhone, you know, she just recorded the whole thing and then he edited it and posted it. It was glorious.
It's amazing. And it's like the fact that the technology is there and, you know, Apple, it sounds a little cliche sometimes, but Apple, by creating the hardware, by creating the silicon, by creating the operating system, you know, you have the ability to do that kind of editing and that kind of recording at such a high level anywhere, anytime.
And we have the podcasting tools and we have the YouTube publishing ability. So, yeah, you can practically create your own news agency.
Yeah, and to some extent, you know, some people are starting to, like, do that. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that unfolds over the future. Retail was kind of an interesting topic there because I wanted to make certain it wasn't going, oh, this is going to change the bricks-and-mortar experience. Because it's actually a lot broader than that. It's, you know, the fact that your phone can provide information about, like, you know, the layout of your house, if you're looking for furniture, you know, your measurements, if you're looking for clothes. And again, it's largely due to the camera itself and then to the augmented reality tools that allow you to really have all that information and know that what you're going to buy is going to look good and it's going to work the way you need it to. And graphics, media, and marketing, that's kind of the very similar to journalism. You can do, if you're running a social media spread, you can do that completely from your phone. If you need to have quick flyers, quick infographics, whatever, you can make them on the fly wherever you are. And it's almost democratizing graphics and media and marketing in a way that we haven't seen before.
Very good. Well, we're running out of time. We have a couple of minutes left, and I'm burning to ask you because you're the one guy I think is going to have a great take on this. Do you think this new MacBook Air replacement we've heard about, the new low-cost MacBook of some kind, is going to have a really good price? And is it going to be driven by an A series chip?
I don't know if in the very ones we're likely to see right now, it's hard to tell if it's going to be driven by an A series chip. One of the things that's interesting to me about like the MacBook Pros, the Touch Bar, is Apple is having its own custom chips in there, but they're not necessarily running everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I could see Apple really kind of having perhaps an Intel processor and then some additional silicon of their own in there. But I could see, you know, 2 to 5 years down the road, Apple would probably feel confident enough to switch to their own chips completely. I don't see that happening immediately. I think we're close to it, but not within like a 6 to 12 month time frame.
Interesting. I saw an article just yesterday that suggested it's coming really soon, and then that's the reason for the delay of the Mac Mini and this low cost MacBook. But that's an interesting perspective. We'll just have to wait and see how that goes.
So. Yeah, the one thing that's, you know, important to realize is Apple has plenty of experience, you know, switching from one processor type or family to another.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, I may be eating my words in a few months and I'll stand up and say, you know what, I did get that one wrong.
Well, don't feel bad because I eat my words all the time and the readers and the listeners know it. Well, we really are out of time now. We're going to have to wrap it up. First, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. Your perspectives are great. And all you listeners, you should go to Computer World and read Ryan's columns all the time. And he's a great writer, and I've appreciated his work for years. So tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
The easiest way to get me is Twitter. It's just my name, Ryan Faas, RyanFaas. You can also find me on Google Plus. I do have a Facebook page if you want to look that up. But Twitter is where I spend a good deal of my time, so it's probably the easiest way to follow me and get in touch with me.
All right, great. Well, thanks again for being on the show. It was a pleasure, Ryan.
It was an absolute thrill.
Folks, you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.